Our next guest is, I would say, a very controversial investigative journalist, Jascha Levin. I learned to know you by reading an interview in the German magazine Konkret. Maybe you remember that. And I was really challenged by your thoughts, also especially on the community we are in as computer scientists, often in this hacker community, because you gave us something to think there about all the technologies we like so much. So I'm really happy to learn to know you now here in person. And Jascha Levin will speak about Empire and Power, the forgotten history of the internet as a weapon. This is really a topic which our fifth Forum of Computer Scientists for Social Responsibility is always talking about. This is our topic, that the but it's also a controversial topic, if the internet and how much the internet is really related to military. So I'm looking forward to it. Thanks.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Thanks for inviting me. I'm pretty convinced that the internet is a weapon because my own cloud, iCloud, was weaponized against me. I thought it had synced, you know, so I prepared a nice lecture notes and decided to leave my computer at home and just take my iPad. And then when I got here, I realized that it didn't upload into the cloud. And so it's now stuck in New York. And so I was feverishly trying to type it back all out from my head. So I hope it'll be kind of coherent. And I'll try to keep it somewhat short, because I think I enjoy my having a dialogue and a conversation with people rather than just sort of droning on and on and on about and losing people in the process. My talk is going to be about the weaponization of the internet, or the so-called weaponization of the internet, because to me, and based on the historical research and journalism that I've done, and the book that I wrote recently called Surveillance Valley, to me, the internet was always a weapon. It was designed to be a weapon from the very beginning, and we're kind of seeing the kind of logical conclusion of that beginning today. And so, people are suddenly terrified of the internet, right? The way that we talk about the internet has really changed, I think, in the kind of the popular culture. I'm not talking about just the professional engineers or computer scientists, but in the popular culture, people are talking about the internet in a completely different way than they talked about it just a few years ago. I mean, in essence, I think Donald Trump is to blame for it all, because after Donald Trump was elected, suddenly this idea of the internet as being a progressive force, a force of democracy and egalitarianism, for whatever its flaws and limitations, that fundamentally that this technology represents something good and democratic, that has begun to be turned upside down. And I mean, I don't know what kind of, unfortunately I can't read German, so I don't know what kind of discussions are taking place in the press here about the internet and about, you know, the weaponization of the internet. But in America, I mean, it's almost absurd, the kind of stuff that you hear now. I mean, the internet is being blamed for just about everything, and the internet now is being looked at as, you know, as what was a democratic technology that had been hijacked by these malicious forces and that have turned this what was once a democratic technology into a weapon that essentially has no limits to its power. And with this minimal investment in this technology, with, you know, just $50,000 on Facebook ads, you can essentially throw an election. That's how powerful it is, and that's how dangerous it is. And we get, you know, day after day, we have stories coming out in the press about, you know, frightening stuff that, you know, you get the sense that the internet really is a kind of a battering ram against democracy now. And there is a consensus that's emerged about the need to control and limit it and restrict it in some way, to merge it with kind of the national security apparatus, and to make sure that the internet is subservient to the national security needs of the state. And I mean, this is very interesting because just a few years ago, internet freedom and openness was considered a virtue, was considered the foundational reasons for why the internet was so successful and what explained its democratic potential. And so, you know, America would berate anybody who tried to enforce their own kind of national laws or cultural notions on the internet, on their own internet space within their own borders, and it would see that as a kind of a totalitarian tendency. And so, you know, there's been an almost like a 180 degree turn with the way that people look at the internet, the way that people see the internet. You know, and another thing about this change is that people act as if it's something new, as if this weaponization, as if the use of the internet by a foreign power or by a state to influence people or to influence politics or to influence culture, to meddle in some kind of way in the political process or just in cultural process, is something new. That until Donald Trump was elected and installed as president, the internet was naive and neutral, right? And these malicious forces came in and completely corrupted it and turned it into a weapon. And of course, the internet is a weapon, and it has been weaponized, but it's always been weaponized. That's what it was designed to do. It was designed by the Pentagon, by the American military, in the 1960s, to be a weapon, to be an information weapon, to be a management weapon, for the military, for a global military presence, but also domestically as well. And so, and as I said earlier, you know, what we're seeing now is the sort of the logical conclusion of that initial push. The internet is now pervades everything and touches everything in our society, and so its potential to be weaponized is much greater than it was, of course, in the 1960s when it was just a kind of a network that could transfer data and could kind of an early cloud service, essentially, what it was back then. And so, you know, this history, let me see here. This is where my notes get messed up. and the reason this idea of the internet as a weapon, the reason it's controversial is because we've forgotten the history of the internet, and because its history has been obscured, and large parts of it just forgotten. And so, in order to understand what the internet is, we kind of have to go back to history, because when it was created in the 1960s, the fact that it was a weapon, the fact that it was very obvious to people back then, this was something that was on the tips of people's minds. People talked about it. People protested it. And so I want to focus on a specific episode from that history. This is probably my favorite forgotten history of the internet, because it encapsulates so much of what we're concerned about now, and yet it has been completely shunted from our cultural memory. So to do that, I want to start with a story from 40 years ago. It took place in September 1969 when a protest broke out at Harvard University. Several hundred people marched through campus and occupied buildings and refused to leave. A similar protest broke out at MIT. The campuses were papered over with flyers and posters that denounced what they called, quote, computerized people manipulation, and warned that a new high-tech colonialism was being developed on campus that would enslave mankind. What were they protesting? They were protesting the ARPANET, which is the military network that would become the internet a few decades later. From a historical perspective, these protests were incredible because they took place a month before the ARPANET actually went online. So the ARPANET went online, and the first node was between UCLA and Stanford, and that happened in October 1969. These protests took place in September. So even before the network went live, there were students at these universities who knew what it was and looked at it as a weapon and talked about it as a weapon. They were not only protesting it, but they had formed a pretty sophisticated and, to us today, seems very contemporary critique of this technology and why it posed a danger to society. So they saw the ARPANET quite simply as a weapon. They saw it as an information weapon, a management weapon that enhanced the power of the US military and enhanced the power of big corporations to wield power domestically, but also around the world. And they saw this technology as a threat to progressive and left-wing movements. And so the reason they were able to have such a kind of a prescient understanding of the ARPANET and of the internet that they didn't even really know was going to occur or to be born was that they were able to get their hands on a controversial proposal for a project called the Cambridge Project. It has no affiliation with the Cambridge Analytica. And this proposal, this secret proposal, was drafted by J.C.R. Licklider, who was the now kind of famous founder of the ARPANET. He was an ARPA manager who was invited to set up the ARPANET program, essentially. And the project that he was proposing that would be part of the ARPANET program, that would be plugged into the ARPANET, was a kind of an 8-bit version or an Atari version of what Palantir does today. So it would be run as a cloud service on the ARPANET, so anybody who had an ARPANET terminal and access to that service would be able to log into it. And it provided, for at the time, were sophisticated database and data management tools and software that were remotely based. And so an intelligence analyst could upload whatever kind of data they had, and it could be structured in a database, and it could be then manipulated and analyzed in whatever way they wanted to do it. You could upload surveillance dossiers, financial transactions, opinion surveys, whatever, right? And then you can use that to generate predictive models, to map out social relationships, to create just searchable databases that would be available to anybody with an ARPANET connection. To do the things that we now take for granted and we just are a part of what, computers do. And this proposal had a specific emphasis because it was, of course, a military proposal and it was had a military aim. And its aim was to aid the counterinsurgency mission of the United States government that was dominating American military policy at the time. And the idea behind this program was that it would allow kind of American military planners to get a better sense of what was going on in these places. So you could ingest data on political movements, mix it with opinion surveys and polls, and to try to maybe even predict conflict or predict an outbreak of a revolution, and to essentially kind of drill down into a population and to see what's going on and who's who. And to students at the Cambridge Project and the larger ARPANET system that it ran on, they saw it as a weapon, and they saw that this network that was being designed was a network of surveillance and political control and that it was part of a larger trend that was happening on university campuses across the United States at the time, was that all sorts of weapons and military research was being conducted at these universities. And so they saw it as very much a part of that, and they were opposed to it. They didn't see computers at the time as tools of liberation. In fact, very few people saw computers as technologies of freedom or democracy at the time. At the time, people saw computers as tools of power and tools that could allow powerful organizations, whether they're corporations or governments, to expand their power and to more effectively wield their power, because those computers were huge, large, right? They were very expensive, and they could only be purchased by these institutions. And so for people back then, it was very clear that computers and power were connected. And so the ARPANET was very much just a part of that larger fear. And they saw the ARPANET as a tool that would facilitate the centralization of power. The students at Harvard and MIT demanded that this project be shut down and that this research not take place. Of course, they didn't succeed. But they turned out to be right. The Cambridge projects went on for 5 years and developed a pretty robust platform for that allowed intelligence analysts to work with large data sets. And in fact, the CIA, in a recently declassified memo, talked about how at the time, and this was now the early 70s, that at the time, the Cambridge project and the ARPANET that gave access to it were the most sophisticated analysis tools that were available to a CIA analyst. There was nothing better than that. So it was a Palantir version of Palantir of the 1970s. But then it got kind of hairier, because about 6 years after the protests, an NBC journalist aired a series of reports on primetime television, 1976, exposing a surveillance program that spied on millions of Americans and took files that were collected by the U.S. Army, illegally collected on American anti-war protesters, on civil rights leaders, on anybody essentially connected to a left-wing or progressive organization in America. And they took these files, and instead of destroying them like they were ordered to by Congress, they used the ARPANET and the Cambridge projects to digitize them and to make them immortal and to make them easily accessible to the NSA, to the CIA, to the White House. And this was a huge scandal. So it got 3 nights of coverage on NBC News. Millions of people watched it at the time, and these broadcasts went very deeply into the ARPANET, its architecture, why it was an advancement over previous database technologies. And the thing that really shocked people about the ARPANET was that it showed that you didn't really need these big centralized databases, these big, you know, Big Brother databases that had everything about you in them, because people were worried about, you know, the one big government database that all your information is in. And there were a number of proposals to build those things, and they were all shut down because people were worried about them, because it was just too obvious, right? What the ARPANET did was that it showed that you didn't need one big database. You could have a bunch of little databases, and what mattered was connectivity between them and the ability to easily access them from any other point in the network. And so there were two things that were happening with this broadcast. One is that they confirmed the fears of the protesters from 6 years ago. They worried that these tools would be used to surveil progressive movements and left-wing activists. But they also showed that a kind of an evolution in terms of the way that of the architecture of surveillance, in that it didn't need to be centralized. The storage of the information didn't need to be centralized, and that all you really needed was a system that allowed access to smaller databases distributed wherever they were, as long as they were connected to the network. And so, you know, but really to understand, I think, To understand why the internet was always a weapon, it's I think important to go back to the larger cultural and political environment in which it was built. Because back then in the 1960s, you know, America was still a relatively new empire, overseeing an increasingly chaotic world. It was fighting insurgencies all around the world, from Southeast Asia to Latin America. And it was also facing an increasingly hostile domestic situation. There was the anti-war movement, there was the civil rights movement, there was militant black activism, there were groups like the Weather Underground that were bombing federal buildings. It seemed like there was revolution happening around the world, and also a revolution happening internally. And so in America, military planners and politicians saw this as two sides of one fight, right? That both of these things were connected, and they were both connected to the Soviet Union. That the Soviet Union, while it was fighting this kind of cold war with America, traditional military and nuclear forces, it was also fighting a new hybrid war against America by funding insurgencies all around the world and funding protest movements and opposition movements in America. And so, in certain rarefied circles in the military at the time, it was believed that in order to fight this new kind of war, you needed a new kind of weapon, a new kind of management weapon that could allow military planners, generals, politicians to see the world in real time, essentially, to have as much as possible. That was the dream. And there was already a precedent, an example of this being done. In the 1950s, America started building the first computer-run early warning radar system called SAGE, which then later became the NORAD. And this was a sprawling system with these giant IBM computers sitting in these bunkers. But what it showed was that you could create a surveillance network, a network that sits on top of the world and watches the world in real time, and you can condense it down to a display screen, and that an analyst sitting at a screen can actually observe thousands of miles of border. And the idea was that to expand that, to expand that, not just to have that to observe the sky, but to have that for society in general. And J.C.R. Licklider, the man who set up the program that built the ARPANET, worked on the SAGE program. And in particular, he built the graphical user interfaces for the displays, the radar displays. And he was inspired by this. And he came to ARPA with this inspiration on his mind. But he believed that in order to have this kind of new command and control system that could watch the world, you needed to start on a much more fundamental level. You needed to build the generic building blocks that would make up this system. So you wouldn't have to build a new system from scratch for every application, which is what happened back then. So you need to create a generic computer and network system that could be universal, that you could use it to send emails and to share files, or you can use it to do whatever you want. Excuse me. Hold on a second. Yeah. So I mean, sorry. This is what I mean when I lost all my notes. Yeah, so Licklider believed that, you know, the military needed to build a much more universal computer and networking platform that could be modified with minimal effort to handle just about any task, whether it was missile tracking or behavioral studies or just databases or voice communications or whatever. And so the computer, this computer framework needed some components, you know, some basic components. It needed intuitive graphical user interfaces. It needed, a kind of somewhat universal operating systems that could share applications. And it, of course, it needed to be connected to other systems, and it needed a robust networking component that could allow it to work. And so, you know, that's what Licklider aimed to do with the ARPA when he joined ARPA, and you know, he laid the groundwork for the ARPANET, and the ARPANET, of course, became the internet that we use today. And so, the internet and its infrastructure and the institutions that surround it, you know, are all born out of this sense that we need to create a modern command and control system. And so, you know, it was driven by military needs back then, and it's still very much driven by military needs today, even although it's gotten, become a lot more complex, and there's a lot of commercial services built on top of it, but still the core of the internet is military. And I think I'll end there. We can take questions. Is it?
Thank you very much. So this was quite short, so we have a nice time to discuss. And I already see a hand up. So maybe before you are there, I have a question too. For me, this is not really forgotten history. How come that you say it's forgotten history?
Which part?
That the ARPANET comes from the military.
Well, it's not just the it's, of course, everyone knows that the ARPANET came from the military. Obviously, it's the, you know, the Advanced Defense Projects Agency, the R&D wing of the Pentagon. The forgotten history is, I guess, the part about the fact that it was a surveillance that was used for surveillance and weaponized from the very beginning. That's the whole point of it. And so, you know, there's a general history of the internet that in which the internet was made by the military and it was born in the military, but that quickly went away somehow, right? And it became this kind of just an academic project that even though it was born in the military, it didn't really have military applications, you know, past that for the very few years. And so when you actually drill down into the internet, the military applications were there at every stage, they didn't go away. So I know that, of course, people know about that it came out of the Pentagon and came out of the military, but there's, I think, a belief that it didn't stay that way for long, or it very quickly veered away into a kind of civilian academic trajectory.
Okay, so now the first question from the audience.
Hello, my voice is not that good today. I hope you can understand me.
Oh yeah.
Many people of those who were involved with ARPANET are now famous in a way and interviewed many times. You mentioned the students who actually protested ARPANET even before it was launched. So I was wondering what happened to those students, what actually happened to those thoughts who opposing the ARPANET, and did you ever come in contact with students, find out what they're doing now, or if how this discussion was continued maybe?
No, it's a really good question. I tried extremely hard to track down some of these students. There were not a lot of names associated with the protesters because it was covered in the press at the time. And it was actually a big story locally and somewhat a little nationally. Obviously, locally, there was written about about the MIT and Harvard protests, and there was a booklet that they even published. So the group that was opposing the ARPANET was the Students for Democratic Society, which was this, many of you probably have heard of it. It's this really influential and left-wing student organization that came out in the 1960s. And they, their Harvard chapter was able to get their hands on this proposal. And they created a little booklet that explained, you know, talked about the history of the ARPANET, the people behind it, and there were names of the people who produced that booklet. I tried to track them down and was not able to do so. What I was able to do was to track down the journalist who reported that story and who reported, who broke the story about the ARPANET and the Cambridge projects being used to spy on Americans. And he you know, this is the, his stories are in the congressional record. They are, you know, they are in the archives, the NBC archives. He even wrote a book about it called Techno Spies, about the early history of the ARPANET and how it was used for surveillance and how it fit into the larger military context. And so, but those things were totally forgotten. Almost as soon as those stories came out, they were eclipsed by a larger movement, a larger idea of the internet that kind of shunted away its military origins and its military aspect and clothed it in this counterculture narrative of communes and cybernetics and the kind of the early wired style approach, Wired magazine style approach to looking at this technology. And so they those things just got, just they dropped down to the bottom of the ocean almost. And what surprised me is that as soon as I went into the archives and began to look, you know, at look at this history, they floated to the top. They were there for anyone to see. You go to MIT and look through the archives of the Cambridge Project, you have clippings from these protests. So the people who are running this program, you know, they were obviously monitoring these protests against them. And so they were clipping all the newspaper articles and saving them. And they even had a booklet, some of the materials, protest materials that were published by that group were actually in the archives at MIT of the ARPANET archives. And so, and those archives, you know, they were very well worn. People, there's a number of people have gone through them. There's a great book written about J.C. Ehrlichleiter called The Dream Machine. That briefly mentions this protest, but it was never given kind of a strong weight or an importance. And so that aspect, you know, just has been forgotten, and time has kind of just covered it up with new things. But no, I did not, unfortunately, have not been able to track down those people.
Hi, thanks. Hello. For your talk that you came in here from New York yesterday.
Yep, I appreciate it. Thank you for having me here.
Yes.
I'm sorry I'm a little bit like not enough sleep and a little bit.
Most of us, I think, are computer scientists, and if you talk about the core of the internet or so, we may think about TCP, IP protocols,
yes,
request for comments, where people are discussing how the internet should be working and shaped.
Yes.
So, and you said that the internet was by design created as a weapon to spy on. On what level did you find some evidence, or did you read something about, is it about shaping TCP as an open standard where packets flowed through the internet unencrypted, or was the idea to spread this technology to all the people that they are using it with their smartphones later, like 40, 50 years later?
Yeah. Yeah.
So on what level did you find interviews or documents?
Well, look,
We can find patterns in the technology itself.
I mean, so the first part of your question is, yeah, there on the standards level, there's definitely involvement. Some of the stuff is basically classified, and we won't maybe know even for years about the NSA's role in shaping the architecture of the internet. But for instance, one different way that they shaped it was that to kill a proposal to do end-to-end encryption as part of the TCP/IP standard protocol. And so I think it was in like 1972 or a little bit later. I don't exactly know exactly when that proposal was brought in, but the NSA came in and said, no, we don't want end-to-end encryption, because there was a proposal to do that, to implement that, to make it a mandatory, right? And they killed that because they didn't want encryption on the non-military or non-classified military portions of the internet. They just didn't want it. And so they've, at a very early stage, they shaped that standard. And so we're dealing with that now, actually today, with the attempt to do end-to-end encryption on a kind of a service level, right? And so there are other examples of that nature. But they're, again, like they those are either coming out and bit by bit in people's interviews, but they're not really well known. I know that a really great historian of the internet is working on a book about that right now, and it hopefully should be out next year about how, on a standards level, how involvement by the NSA specifically, because it was involved on a much greater level than people realize in terms of shaping this. On your second part of your question, yeah, I mean there wasn't a I know what you mean. There wasn't a conspiracy in like 1969, you know, when they launched that first node to create Facebook, right, and to create Android phones and to spy on us. I mean, obviously, the ARPANET, there was not even a guarantee that it was going to become a commercially successful network. I mean, a lot of things had to happen for that to occur. You know, the ARPANET was overseen by ARPA, and then it was handed over to the DISA, which is the kind of the communications agency of the Pentagon in the 1970s, and then it was privatized and it was turned into the National Science Foundation Net, NSFNet, and that NSFNet was privatized and became the commercial internet that we use today. And so there were a number of stages, right? But what's important is that it all came out of the ARPANET, and it came out of ARPA, and it came out of this military. It came out of this military project, and the involvement of the military didn't end when the internet became privatized. I mean, I don't know, like one just obvious example to use in this case is sort of how military grants, research grants that drive the development of technology. So I'm sure you probably all, you know, since you are. Computer science professionals and maybe are studying at a university here, like I don't know how it is in Germany, but in America, the computer science departments are sustained in large part because of defense grants of various kinds, right? And they don't really, it's not a conspiracy, right? But they do drive the direction of research. And like a good example, I guess, is I don't know. It's like, you know, Google being coming out of a DARPA grant to create a digital library, and so you know Google probably wouldn't have existed in the way that it has exists now without that funding. And as soon as Google became commercially viable, it was began selling its services back to the national security state that basically brought it into being, and so. I think you know the whole profession is kind of sustained by a background national security influence and funding and direction. You know, I think what's also interesting about the ARPANET is not that it just created the network, but it also created modern computer science in America. So computer science departments are largely the byproduct of the ARPANET program, and because computer science didn't even exist as a separate profession, it was electrical engineering or whatever. But ARPANET sustained funding over many years created these permanent computer science departments, and they're very much so. That network that ARPA created was actually more than just the communication network, but actually created a network of you know, personalities, but also institutions, and set up the funding for those institutions, and set up kind of patterns for those institutions. So you know, there's the involvement of the military happens at every level, and of course, you know, you have something like as maybe I'm best known around here for is the Tor project, something as obvious as that. I mean, the Tor project is supposed to be an anti-government entity, supposed to protect you from government surveillance, yet it's almost entirely sustained through government funding and contracts from the Pentagon, contracts from the State Department. Not just here, have some money, do whatever you want with it, but actual contracts with deliverables and things like that. So how is it possible that even the parts of this network that are supposed to be against you know, the military, against the Pentagon or against the national security state in America, how are they also sustained with funding from that very same entity? And so you can, if you take a sample, you know, a core sample at any level, you'll get essentially to some kind of defense core in a lot of these things.
Yeah, I also want to say thank you for this presentation. Actually, I'm not a computer scientist, so for me, yeah, you nailed it, because I didn't know this history exactly, just I knew that there was something like the ARPANET or something. But what's really interesting for me, and following up on your question, the first question is how, and it's one of your working hypotheses, how did it get obscured? Because this was the original story, and now we're in a time that Amazon, for example, is getting big government contracts to make like cloud systems for the Pentagon, for the NSA, for military, like huge military contracts for all the wars that have been led in the recent years. So how has it been obscured? Because we actually, I don't think we as a society are fully aware of this aspect, because mostly when I look at my, when I discuss with peers and what I experience in everyday life, is that people have still have the impression it's mainly a civic thing, and the military is also doing something like in the internet, and people don't know maybe, but so yeah, this is what I, maybe you can elaborate on this a little bit. How did it get obscured? What did you find out about this aspect?
Well, yeah, I mean, it got obscured because of culture and money, I think, and business. When computers began going mainstream computers began to be a big business in basically the 80s and the 90s, a new kind of cultural sort of stream kicked in that really began to redefine them away from their military roots, and as something that was radical and counterculture, and actually revolutionary. And so, you know, the way that one thing that I really got a sense of while writing this book was the way that memory, cultural memory, is impacted by power and business and business interests, and that like when in the 50s and 60s and the 70s, when people's notion of what a computer was or what a computer network was, I mean, it was intimately seen as a thing that that is wielded by power. It is an instrument of the powerful, an instrument of the powerful to expand their power even more. And people were afraid of them. They saw them as a threat. And in the 80s, and then specifically in the 90s, that really just went like the other way. And you can just see the way that kind of narratives can shift, and I think that's largely a consequence of the fact that, you know, ideas, there is a kind of a marketplace of ideas, or almost a free marketplace of ideas, where certain ideas that are useful to power or useful to business interests or useful to empire are funded very profusely, and ideas that go against that aren't funded at all or aren't given really a space. And eventually, you know, there's the old notions get kind of buried and forgotten. And so it really is a business revolution in a way is what switched it. So it wasn't even a government conspiracy, I don't think, you know, to convince us that this military network is actually a tool of liberty and a tool that'll equalize power between us and giant corporations and giant and governments. It was really the business needs of the computer industry and then of the internet industry to rebrand these things away from their military origins. I mean, you know, the classic Apple ad from 1989, right, where Apple is seen as the thing that smashes Big Brother. I mean, it's just a classic example of that, directed by Ridley Scott. So just an idea of that, like that. But if you actually and multiply that by a millionfold in all sorts of different ways. You get a rewriting of history and a rewriting of our conceptual understanding of what computers are. I mean, look, I'm also kind of a layman. I have a slightly better understanding of computers than most people, just because I did half of a computer science degree, and then at UC Berkeley, and then I dropped out of the degree because I realized that I didn't want to sit in front of a computer all my life. But then I became a journalist, and so I sat in front of a computer all my life. So didn't really, and then wrote about computers. So I have a better sense of it, I guess. So I'm not afraid of this technology, just because a lot of people who don't understand how this stuff works, it's like a black box. It's magic, right? It's hard to. It's much easier to kind of to be swayed by this technology, by these ideas. But at the same time, I think, you know, the computer industry and computer scientists and people who work in this field are also very susceptible to this kind of rebranding. And the fact that we're even having this conversation is, I think, a testament of that. So I think it's really about business interests. And smoking was good for you, too, at some point, I remember. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Oh.
I have the microphone, so. I have another question, which is, you've talked about the internet being funded in large part by the military and having a military history. So my question is, what's your idea on how can it be used to actually help bring about more peace in the world?
I'm not sure the internet is going to bring about more peace in the world. Maybe if everyone just sort of gets strapped into a VR console and just sits there on their couch being fed intravenously, you know, maybe there'll be peace. But I don't see the internet as being an instrument of peace. The internet is just a telecommunication system that reflects the kind of the norms of the society that it was invented in and in which it's used. And so the internet is dominated by the military and dominated by spies and owned by these giant corporations, because our society is owned and dominated by these very same forces. And so I think, you know, once you change this, the internet will change along with society. I don't know if the internet will be a driver of change in society. You know, it's just an expression of it. But I have no idea how to bring about world peace. Just, if I did, I'd probably be at a TED talk right now and not here. Just saying.
Okay, I would say just two more questions, please. Okay. Short answers, because now it's only 3 minutes
yep.
left.
So I'll try to keep it short.
All right. First, I just wanted to say thank you very much for coming to this forum. It was quite the pleasure to have you here and to be listening to the aspects of the history of architecture, in particular the history of the internet architecture that we have today, which is largely informed by the ARPANET. But I was hoping this could also lead to discussion, like maybe even tied to the previous question of what is to be done now that we kind of know maybe that the internet we have currently is very tied to a military history. Perhaps by looking at other attempts that occurred during those same 60s and 70s times that maybe weren't as tied to military histories. Would you say that there were any other networks that were attempted to be built during the 60s and 70s that could maybe provide an alternative kind of view? The only one I'm aware of that may have also been in the MIT archives was the work of Eden Medina, who was working on cybernetics of what was going on in Chile. I don't know if you want to comment on anything similar.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's a kind of the socialist. It's interesting because there's networks that were built in the Soviet Union, or there was an attempted kind of Soviet internet to be built, although you couldn't really call it the same way. But it's interesting that in these kind of socialist countries or the socialist movements, what you see there is an attempt to build these networks that could help manage the economy or manage production and things like that. Whereas, you know, in America, the internet was about managing the military, and so what's kind of interesting to me doing this comparative surveillance studies or comparative internet studies is that it was America that created this kind of global surveillance system, and it wasn't like the Soviet Union that did that. In fact, there was not even any proposals for that. The proposals for Soviet networks were about managing society. I mean, there were top secret networks that managed specific things like military installations and missile installations and things like that. But as a kind of a civilian, on a civilian level, they were all about managing the economy and not really managing people or watching people. There was a civilian network in France. You know, there's some other kind of alternatives that got essentially rolled by the expansion of the internet and of ARPANET. In America, there was a moment I think where it kind of could have gone another way, and that was the moment when it was privatized. So the network was handed over to a civilian agency, the National Science Foundation, and then which then prepped it for privatization. And the way that privatization was designed was, I think, instrumental in kind of determining how the internet became what it is today, because it was offloaded to these telecommunications companies that have historically had very close ties to the national security state, and it was privatized to them. It wasn't given over to, let's say, I don't know, the Postal Service, and run in this kind of more of a democratic way, but it was just handed over to giant corporations. And so there was a moment when the internet in America, at least, could have been a bit more democratic, but it didn't go that way because it was privatized at the height of the Reagan era. And it was just, you know, it was ideologically, that's the way it went. So it was national security and privatization and corporate profit. So these are the two things that kind of drove it from that point, and they keep driving it today, I think.
Yes, I think I would like to add another comment. I guess if I would frame it as a question, then that would take a bit more time to answer. What I would like to, or what came to my mind after your presentation, is that you've mostly talked about the internet as a weapon, as surveillance for the people. But when I think about what, for example, Facebook is planning by trying to connecting areas of the world who do not have internet access yet, for example, by weather balloons. In this case, the internet could be used as a tool of colonialism or a weapon of colonialism.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the protesters of that at MIT and Harvard would agree with you. I mean, in fact, they saw this network as a tool of colonialism because. They were against, you know, an American imperial power, and a colonial power essentially. Although they didn't call it that, but and they saw that this network, if allowed to expand globally, and to do its thing, to do what it said it would wanted to do, it would be a tool of colonialism and a tool of colonial power that could be used to watch and control those you know, other people around the world. But of course, it was also done domestically. And so I think again, that's why I think that episode is so interesting, because it's you can draw a straight line from their concerns and their view of the ARPANET and their view of that project that they were protesting against to the internet that exists today, Google, Facebook, Cambridge Analytica, all these things that we're suddenly concerned about. They kind of had a seed of that almost 50 years ago, and so yeah.
All right. Thank you very much,
Yasha
Levine.